Hey, everybody, before you get into the show, which I know you're super excited to hear because every fucking show of Thinking Outside the Long Box is amazing, we want to thank our Patreon supporters, Chad, Ryan, Derek, Doyle, Devin, Taylor, Jason, Steve, and now Christine. Thank you so much for being a part of this show by donating to us on Patreon. If you, too, would like to support this show and keep it going every other week after every other week, then you can go to patreon.com/TOTLB, where you can get your choice of all sorts of cool bonus videos and awesome prizes like hats and t-shirts, original sketches. I don't know if you guys follow Tim Husky's artwork on Instagram, but one of those original sketches got colored and it was fucking amazing. So join us today at patreon.com/TOTLB. And to those of you who are already subscribed, thank you so much. We appreciate you more than our own assholes.
Characters and sort of getting optics on what the rest of the world looked like at the beginning of the story has really helped me as I'm writing the later part of the story, as I'm currently pushing the ball down the field on hard arts.
A huge portion of the comic is Wesley Craig's art.
Yes.
It's freakishly beautiful, especially when we get into like a lot of the psychotropic, trippy kind of scenes and stuff. How did you guys go about bringing that to life, and were you able to find like a specific cinematographer that you really like to help bring that vision to life?
I don't think that we had any specific comps. I think that our idea when we would talk about the psychedelic stuff was to try and do things that were visually interesting that still spoke to character. So that if there was something involved in the trip, if the trip was still moving the ball down the field and developing the human that's having the trip, and that it wasn't solely just like Yellow Submarine-ing it. And in some cases, it was all about getting to the core of what it's like to be on one of those psychedelics. Which, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about with some of the animators that are going to be doing that episode of the show is focusing on the smaller moments as opposed to the bigger ones. Trying to pay for cigarettes when you are on acid, and how to like make the money work, and the beef jerky's breathing. And what did it say? And just that simple thing that became like, I don't know. There was three stories that came up about people who were trying to buy cigarettes or buy something at a Circle K. Where I think all three of them ended with people just going like, and running out of the circle. Fuck it! So in terms of the Wes of it all, look, I mean, like, the first time I saw Wes's work, it's like, I always try to work with people that are clearly geniuses that might not be recognized as such. And in terms of Wes, the first time I saw his work, I was like, oh, well, Wes is a genius. Wes is like Alex Toth and David Mazzucchelli. And he is a high-level genius. It's the same as Ben Gall, or when I started, you know, found Jerome Pena, or any of these guys, or Matteo Scalera. Or I'm just very fortunate in that, like, I've always, you know, coming from a punk rock background, I'd rather work with hardworking, very talented people that are on their way up than to try to chase after rock stars. And so in Wes, what I got very fortunate with was also, like, a friend and somebody that I like talking with and somebody who we became very close. He's also just a great guy. And so in developing these things, a lot of the time, for certain action sequences or some of the psychedelic stuff, I'll just call Wes, we'll walk through it, I'll tell him what I'm intending, he'll throw some visuals, I'll throw some visuals, we'll kind of, you know, mold it back and forth. I'll go off and really dig into it and write it, and then what he turns out will always be high art. And in some cases, I'll just let Wes go. I'll give him, like, you know, five sentences for a page. Maria's on a burning bridge. Chico's brother is riding a motorcycle towards her through the fire. She's getting ready. He's coming. And then you just see what Wes does, and it's always great. And I find that, you know, you just have to find that balance between I have a very specific vision, and there's a reason for it. Here's the basic action. Go to town and do your thing. And so,
we always get there. No matter what he does, it's always a beautiful work of art. It's a joy to, you know, figure out what the characters are saying and doing to each other.
What's one of your favorite scenes that you actually like? Obviously, you put some of your favorite music. So, what's one of your scenes that you saw and you're like, man, this couldn't have been worked out more perfect by seeing it come to life on the screen?
In shooting the pilot, there's a lot because we've basically shot the book. But I would say the one that's going to make everybody drool, the one shot that was like when we were doing it, was just hair standing up, everybody looking. We were in Video Village just watching it be filmed, just going like, what the fuck? So for one, we're shooting on anamorphic lenses, so it looks cinematic. We have Tim Ives, who's a cinematographer of Stranger Things. We had Lee Krieger, these guys are high-level talented. And so the thing looks like a David Fincher film. It is stunning. It is not television. And then we've got Joe Russo behind the whole thing, really helping to direct and make sure that what we make is of a caliber that is something that is going to help it rise above the rest of the shows. And I can stand behind that it really is. But I would say that the scene that gets shot is when Maria is in Day of the Dead dancing, and there's fireworks going off behind her, and Marcus is just staring at her in a daze. That scene is, we shot 2 minutes of it. I could have left all two. When we were editing it, that was the hardest bit, because you want to just cut just enough so that you're not lingering too long in it. But I was like, I just think we could watch a show of Maria dancing at the Day of the Dead.
How does Benedict Wong come onto the cast? Did you guys seek him out? Was it just happenstance?
We were casting. We were going through the audition tapes. And I think Joe was filming Avengers 4. And Joe was like, you know, get Benny. And so we reached out, and I think Joe reached out, and we had a couple conversations with him, and he's one of the coolest, nicest people I've ever met in my life. You know, you just immediately love him, and so we just put it all together and made it happen, and it was like, that was incredible. The dude is so fucking good that we would all sit there and go, you could just listen to this guy read the phone book all day. It just doesn't matter anymore. And, you know, fortunately what he's reading is, you know, me and Miles taking a year and developing, you know, the comic book into a teleplay. And, you know, some of what I feel like is the best dialogue I've written coming, you know, through one of the very greatest actors, I think, alive right now. And it was just, I think when people see it, it's pretty spectacular.
I'm curious what he brings to the character, because he's got a much different physicality than is drawn in the book.
Yeah, and look, I mean, you know, it comes down to, like, a lot of the time when you're casting, you have to make, like, okay, he's, you know, in the book he's a much older man. And so you make allowances because, you know, you have to hire a human who can actually do it, and he is a great human to do it. And so we just adjusted the story a little bit to where, you know, and look, I mean, because it's Benny, there's also one of the bigger challenges in the room right now as we're unpacking the season is making sure that Master Lin has a big story. In the book, he was always this mysterious, enigmatic figure in the background. He always has been. And he still is, but now it's about finding ways to connect him to a bigger story that's equally as interesting as what the kids are up to, and then smash those trains into each other. And so it's been something that, you know, when you see how good he is, you want to write the Master Lin show.
Yeah.
You know, the whole cast is so wonderful. But so, yeah, that is a particularly interesting character that gets unpacked in a really big way.
So you've talked in the past about how this is a fairly personal story for you.
Sure.
You know, at one point you had to let it go to have somebody draw it, and now you're kind of letting it go into, like, the realm of television. You know, how does it feel to, like, let such a personal story go?
Well, I'm not letting it go. I'm show running the show.
Well, I know, but
I'm lead writer, so nothing goes anywhere that I don't agree to. So I couldn't let it go. It's not being let go. I spend 10 hours a day in a writer's room, you know, and I'm involved in every aspect of this. I spent 3 months in Vancouver filming it. I am, you know, I'm making the show, and so there is, now in any of these, there is an aspect of collaboration. There's a point where you have to go, like, that control you want has to be vetted. How much of this am I going to control, or is a better idea coming at me from a collaborator? And when a better idea comes, you let it in. And so that is a process that takes a little bit of time and energy, and you have to really make sure that you're listening and being able to blue sky with everyone and go like, well, what if this? But that's what we're doing, you know, all day in the writer's room for the past 2 months, is making sure we do that. And then as for the rest of it, you just make sure that you're hiring the best people. You just make sure you're hiring an amazing cinematographer. You just make sure you're hiring an amazing set designer. You just make sure you're hiring an amazing director. And then at that point, people who are ignited and also very passionate about the book and seeing the pilot, that, you know, you have to go, okay, now do your thing. And what comes back is inevitably, I mean, obviously I'm art directing that stuff and giving notes on it, but what's coming back is spectacular. The show, I think it will absolutely blow people away when they see it. I don't think anyone will be ready for exactly the level of art that we have been pushed to make here.
Could you have ever imagined that this particular story would go from your mind into television?
No. This was the one that was for me. This was the one that made me so happy that it was finally okay to quit Marvel. It was finally okay as a grown up, you know, with a family and kids to support, to say, I got to get away from superheroes and go do this. Because it made me so happy to create it. It made me so happy to see Wes's pages come in. It made me so happy. Every issue of Deadly Class, you know, and all of the creator-owned books scratch different itches. But that one scratched an itch of what my generation, for me, where I came from, the scene I grew up in, the people I was around, that was more of a representation of Generation X and what it was like to be, you know, a kid in that scene in the mid-80s than anything that I've seen. So it's that old, you know, Belle and Sebastian song. They don't make them like they used to, so it might as well be me. And so I just made something that was just, you know, entirely Wes and I getting excited about things and making a comic for us. And it was it was never in my mind something that would end up turning into the snowball that it has. Yeah.
How was the process of obviously writing the comic, getting to where we are now, involving the Russos, getting Benedict on? How did you take each wave of, hey, we're getting this really big people to executive produce, hey, we're getting this really huge actor that's been on 2 Marvel movies to step in? How was that experience for you personally when everything started steamrolling into what it is?
I mean, it's emotionally, it's very gratifying to see people that you respect. I mean, you know, like... I think that Joe and Anthony made the best Marvel movie in The Winter Soldier. And I think Brubaker made the best Cap story with Winter Soldier. So I think that those two things together, you know, when those guys, and I'm a huge fan of their Arrested Development work and their Community work. So when they came on, it was obviously a wonderful, you know, experience to have people of that caliber respect your work and want to be involved in it. They're very particular about what they're putting their name on and what they're working on. But more than that, to get involved in the creative process with them. You know, the late nights with Joe Russo in the editing bay as we're sitting there figuring out where the music goes and how to edit it and cutting the heads and tails off of scenes and making sure that, you know, that the thing is high level, and just seeing Joe work. Like, speed this action bit up. We usually do this. Go bop, bop, bop. And he's just... And it, you know, it's a real treat. And I've learned a whole lot from working with them. But, so, I mean, it's a dream come true. It's incredibly gratifying. All the sort of cliched shit that you would expect me to say. But it is, you know. It's just been a dream come true. And from all the people at Sci-Fi who, you know, have given me control over creative and running the writer's room, to, you know, being a co-showrunner on it, and that's huge, you know, for them to give me that hat to wear. And I'm, you know, working myself to death to make sure that I live up to the expectations that they've put on me.
Is showrunning a job you would pick up again on another show? Like, I know showrunning is important because this is a story that you've been wanting to tell, but is the job of showrunner something that you're enjoying and excited about?
Yeah, you know, it is. I think that for me, I've spent, you know, I ran an animation studio in San Francisco for a number of years, so I have experience doing this in animation, from, you know, taking production from ground to a thing. But it all comes down to your passion for the project, because it is such a monument. There's no off. Like, while I was waiting for this, I had to go through 100 texts and 15 emails. There's no off. You're on. But at the same time, I'm addicted to that creative buzz. I'm addicted to going like, oh, we can't build all these halls. Can we build this hall here? Oh, we have this space for this. Can we do that there? Like, that to me is a huge part of also what we do in animation and comic books. In you know, page count, or what you can't expect, you know, an artist to draw a crowd scene page after page, you know, like any of the limitations and things. And so I am creatively stimulated by it, and being able to see the art come together and actually make what's kind of a dream come true in terms of making a TV show that's an authentic snapshot of not just the teen experience, but my particular teen experience and the people that I knew growing up, and to also then blanket it in the music of my generation and maybe gift that to another generation who didn't know about it. People who might think punk rock is, you know, The Offspring or Avril Lavigne, whatever her fucking name was. Yeah. Shitbox Magoo, whatever that fucking garbage dump of a person singing about skater boys with a Z bullshit. Thank you. Whatever that asshole's bullshit name is. Whatever. But the generation who saw punk rock is just an exploited Blink-182 song about masturbation. Maybe they'll hear the soundtrack and be turned on to things. I know that everybody in the office, all the millennial kids, are just like crazy for it now. They're playing the Toy Dolls and the Attics and running around listening to Agent Orange and the Dead Milkmen and the Cure and the Smiths and New Order. That just plays in the office all the time. And so to me, I remember in 1985, 86, we had a half pipe and we were skating it, and a buddy of mine brought the Stand By Me soundtrack. And we all loved that movie, but we, you know, the 50s music, we were just unexposed. You know, maybe your parents played some of it. And I remember hearing Buddy Holly and just being like, Buddy Holly's fucking incredible. And then just fell in love. I went down a rabbit hole and found, you know, all of these various things. And that led to like rock and roll history down to Muddy Waters, you know, like it just, so hopefully it'll do that to a generation that lost rock and roll. Because rock and roll to them seemed like it was, you know, some guy from Disturbed with a long goatee, you know, or whatever bullshit was being sold to them. So that part of it is a real treat, to be able to take the things that inform me and speak to my soul and have made me an artist and make art with them on a television show. So I would certainly, yeah, show run something again if I had the, and I've got another thing in development, so I'll probably have to, but, it's a real treat, and I hope to make really great art with it so that everybody who's entrusted me with it is rewarded as well.
I almost hate to ask, but with the comic, do you have an end point in mind, or are you just kind of going along as it happens?
I have just a bucket of endless ideas, you know. I would hate to, express any of them too much on a point. But, you know, again, I think in the book right now, we're entering into 1989. There's a lot of years between now and 1989. There's a lot of scenes. There's a lot of music. There's a lot of you know, political things that we can dig into. There's a lot of engine there for those kids if they, you know, as the young adults and students of you know, King's Dominion climb their way through life. I have a shit ton of stories there. So, you know, I don't think I would do the book without Wes. So it really is going to come down to sort of how long we can, you know, keep Wes drawing the same thing. Because as an artist, it is a bigger commitment. You know, I can go off and write, you know, a couple four things. And Wes lives and breathes Deadly Class. You know, he might do some covers, but this is a commitment where, and again, you know, you can never reiterate it enough. We're here because of Wes. I'm here because of Wes. I'm here because of Wes's commitment to the book. I'm here because Wes sits down every single day and draws a page or two of Deadly Class. And, you know, I do my very best to honor that and write to the best of my ability with the most philosophy and heart that I can pour into the comics. But, you know, moving forward, there is an unlimited amount of stories in as long as Wes is still willing to draw them.
Great. At some point, The Walking Dead TV show almost caught up with a comic. Kirkman had to release two comics a month. Are you nervous at all that at some point maybe the TV show will eventually catch up to the comic and you might have to do something?
If that's the worst problem I've got to look at down the barrel of, I'll take it. The good news is that, you know, as somebody who is, you know, very, very involved with both of them and creating both of them, if I hit that problem, I have an outline, and that if the show overshoots the comic book, then I guess we'd be at season 6 of the show. So, hey, future me, congratulations.
And with that being said, you're working on the TV show, you have an extra project that's coming in, Lowe's coming out and all this. Is it hard to juggle 3 or 4 comics at this point with two shows or one show and secret project that I guess we're not going to mention currently?
Secret project.
Is it hard to be juggling all these things now?
No, it's easy. Everything's fine. I'm great. Plenty of time for myself. No, I mean, I'm a fucking train wreck. I work from you know, 7 in the morning and until midnight. But I love it. I'm a sick person. I can't. No, I love it. I've got a bug. I've got a bug that will kill me. You know, that's the old quote: find what you love and let it kill you. And so I'm letting this kill me. But it's so much fun. It's just so much fun. Every step of this, as hard as it is, it's very gratifying. It's exciting. You know, I still love making comics. I still love when a comic book comes out. I still love seeing them. The newest issue of Death or Glory, when Ben Gall and I put it to bed and it came out and it saw print, you know, I still take a minute to like take a go, hey, yeah, you made some art, and look at it and look at what Ben Gall did and feel. And I feel like such a sense of pride because, you know, I think that we've made something really special with all of these books. The same with, you know, when you see the new issue, what Jerome has been working on. Jerome is now spending like sometimes 5 days on a page on Seven to Eternity. And so it's still just a huge goddamn privilege and joy to be able to write stories for that caliber of artist. And then to have people pay a ticket price to take the ride with you. I mean, that is something that I'll never take for granted. And so, where do I hit the wall? I don't know. For now, I'm writing a feature. I've got another one of my things being filmed for a feature that hasn't been announced. I've got another show in development, and I've got you know, Deadly Class, which we're doing, which is, you know, going to be a TV show in 2019. And so the comic books, when I get home at night, I go down to my basement and I open the comics and I work on those until I basically fall asleep with the computer. And then I get up and go to the office, and then I do that 7 days a week, and I just don't take any time off. Like, this is, coming to Comic-Con is going to fuck my schedule. Like, it is. Well, like, four days off of work for Comic-Con, I come back, that's 4 days of, you know, minus 16 hours of the day. Like, you know, I'll Black Science will be late.
You talk a ton about music and growing up in that era. You know, I've come from that era of reading liner notes and finding out
what band,
find a new band, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you kind of hope that in some ways this show will be like the mixtape for another generation of kids?
I mean, yeah. I mean, all I know is that there was so much great music that seemed to, it just disappeared. You know, the Generation X culture was just disappeared. So if a new generation hear this and they react the same way as the younger people in the office do, when they hear Agent Orange, they're like, what the fuck is this? And when they hear the Toy Dolls, and when they hear, you know, a Bad Religion song, you know, fuck Armageddon, this is hell. Remember, like, seeing like what the people faces light up, like, what the fuck is going on? And you're like, yeah, you know, people used to play instruments and sing about really, like, you know, personal things or political things. And, you know, like, that was what that music was honest, and it was kids, you know, from the birth of what really took off as hip hop, from the birth of what really took off as punk, it's poor kids talking about their circumstances and making their own fucking scene. And I think that we need more of that. I think we need more in terms of artistic movements and music and all of these things, is to reignite the spirit of do it yourself. Quit looking for quick fame on YouTube, you know, all of these hollow goddamn investments that we've all fallen into on this digital world. And if somebody, if a handful of 24-year-old kids find that stuff and they hear a Damned album and it makes them start a band and pick up a bass and a guitar and a set of drums and they actually make music, that's fucking amazing, because that's what happened to me. That's why I'm here, you know, is that scene, hearing Ian MacKaye talk in another state of mind. You know, and realizing that, like, there was other people that didn't see much value in misogyny or beer or driving a Camaro, you know, hearing people talk about that when I was, you know, growing up in Phoenix, Arizona, it was like a mutant who had crawled into my brain and expressed my thoughts back at me, and I didn't feel alone anymore. And art at its highest form makes people identify and feel not alone. And I think that, you know, that's what guys like, you know, Henry Rollins and the Bad Brains and all the, you know, and Jack and TSOL and all those bands, that's what they gave me. And they gave me the spirit of doing it myself no matter what, to the point where no matter how many good cushy jobs I've had, I can't be comfortable taking a corporate job and pushing things down the field. I have to go and make my own shit and do it myself.
Is there music that's coming out like now where you're like, oh shit, those guys are doing it right? Like,
different, For sure, but it's like it's not. There's nothing aggressive. I mean, like, that's not true. There's like a lot of good metal, and I think that like lately it's. But you know, if I went through it, it was you know, the instrumental stuff, the Tame Impalas, the you know, Health is making a lot of great music. There's a lot of great like you know like noise rock and electronic music. But I don't hear, and it's also maybe a symptom of being a 45-year-old guy. And I go to Twitter all the time, and I go, "What's the punk rock you guys are making?" And Henry Rollins promoted the Savages, and they're great. And you know, there are so many, but they feel like scattered. I mean, there's not a scene anymore. I went and saw when Jawbreaker got back together, and they toured. I went to go see Jawbreaker, and he got up there, and he was just like, "This is a guitar." He goes, and this is how we play music, you know, like, I loved it because it's like, I don't know where that got lost. I don't know where rock and roll disappeared. I don't know where that became, you know, every generation since the 50s has had their version of it, and then it disappeared. And I think that there's something about it that I think that we're lacking. And so in terms of what's made now, I definitely dig up stuff and find there's, you know, I'm not old man barking at the clouds. I think that there's a lot of great music, and I still buy a couple albums every week, and I buy them. I don't Spotify them or get one of these $10 services. I pay for the album to try to support the artist and keep them working. But I think that if the heart of what inspired the DIY 80s from hip hop to punk to goth to metal to any of those things could be reignited. And I don't think that it's thinly laundered. It's not like self-praise. I'm not saying my generation was right. Every generation looks at the next generation. And, you know, it's the same way that we looked at the boomers and the hippies. And we said, you know, you fucking, come on, people now, fuck you. And, you know, we had our, the pendulum swings, right? And so the hippies were all about peace and love.
Well, there's a 7-second song about it.
Yeah.
We're going to succeed where the hippies failed.
That's right.
And
we also failed. And then in Bad Religion have a song about, you know, empty causes. And every generation has their causes. And they're like, we're the this, and we're going to change that. And the pendulum just went this way. And I would like to see, you know, I know I've raised my kids on punk rock.
Right.
You know, and I know a lot of other people do. You know, like my son's favorite, you know, bands are Bad Religion and The Descendants. You know, he just wanted to, and I didn't push it. I was just listening to it, and he just loves it. So maybe that generation comes back and picks up guitars and starts making fuck you music again, you know? Like, because
we can only hope.
We need some fuck you music. We need some fuck you music.
I feel like it's found more currently in hardcore rather than like in punk rock, because punk rock is just, the venues have died and shut down and
sure.
Stuff like that, so it's so hard, like you say, to find someone new when there's nowhere to go.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but then you could get into like, you know, the line between what's hardcore and punk rock anymore, because what you are probably referring to as punk rock was originally called hardcore, you know,
yeah,
like, so like,
circle
jerks. Sure. You know, and then so like modern hardcore is probably quite different than what has now become punk rock. It's all just, you know, subsets, but in certain, you know, ultimately what you would hope is just, you would just hope that, you know, what I've seen is just like, well, like when I was exposed to different music is how, like what you said, you chase bands down, you go through the liner notes and you find new things. What I've been seeing with a lot of the people in the office and Deadly Class is just younger kids hearing stuff that they hadn't heard, you know, and loving it. So it's really just about exposure. And where do you get that exposure? I think that the generational divide between millennials and Gen X aren't that great. I think that ultimately, like, that, you know, there's a lot both generations share in common, as opposed to, you know, sort of the boomers and the silent generation before them. But in a dream world, that, you know, we're selling a lot of these soundtracks and igniting a lot of people to, you know, find and love stuff, you know, again, you know, in a dream world. But ultimately, if not, then I still got to make a TV show and make a soundtrack that I love.
Out of sheer curiosity, you mentioned the Toy Dolls. What song do you use in this season?
I haven't picked the Toy Doll song yet.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's that. We closed the pilot with The Damned, and I don't want to tell you what song because you might think you know it, but you don't. No, the pilot has The Descendants, Agent Orange, Sisters of Mercy, the Damned, Too Short, Killing Joke, N.W.A. A couple of few others that I'm probably forgetting. New Order. So you got to mix some of that in there, too.
The only reason I ask, I just imagine someone like in a car going fast and listening to Modern School Motory by Toy Dolls.
Sure, sure, yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
Just making it something funny and silly.
Yeah, that. Look, I mean, you know, trying to budgetarily how many songs we can fit in really comes into it. So, like, I'm just having to go through, and I'm also trying to, like, score the show with the music so that it's not just me going, like, I got to get this song in. It's really about looking at the scene, what is informing the scene and what the scene is about, and then I go through my music collection, and I'll spend, you know, days and days just listening to albums and find the song. And the song is normally a deep cut off of an album that was not their big album, but it's the right one for that scene. And so I that's sort of the methodology I'll be using moving forward as I kind of, you know, soundtrack the show.
Is it weird having to deal with the rights situation on bands that, like, you know, release the tape from the back of their van and scream fuck you to the government?
No, because I want them paid.
Right.
They're older now, and they made music that changed my life, and I'd like them to get paid. So I don't see, like, in terms of that, I'm very glad to put some money in the pockets, you know, and, you know, and being able to, like, hire Henry Rollins and see him play a role and read your dialogue when you know, in 1988, his spoken word and his writing sort of changed your life and changed the trajectory of where you were headed. And so... and for me, it's like, you know, we're looking at a lot of, you know, punk rock stunt casting and, you know, bringing the heroes in. And in terms of getting the you know, there's a lot. Hip hop is the biggest problem because of the samples. So, like, there's an Eric B. and Rakim song that I was just dying to put in, and there's a Public Enemy song I was dying to put in. But, you know, in 86, 87, you know, when those acts were first beginning, they were samples galore.
Right.
So you can't use it, but, you know, NWA on that first album, NWA and the Posse have a bunch of things that are some of their familiar songs, but they were sample free. They were still just using, you know, Dre was using drum machines and it was pretty simplified. But I do like that. I won't name the band, but a couple of the punk bands, the rights are owned by all the members, and so you have to go to all of them to get it.
Wow.
And I like that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, man. I like that. That's still how that goes.
Did you get, like, Henry?
No. It's modern Henry playing a teacher, but there's a lot of cool stuff for him coming up too. I can't talk about it.
How does the violence compare, like, from the comic to the show? Because, like, Wes can make the violence look almost, like, beautiful. And if you were to literally translate it, it would almost be gratuitous.
It would be gratuitous, and it would be ugly. And so one of the things I realized in developing the show is that I never want to see a gun in a military academy like King's. And so it was just a quick fix of, like, well, Master Lin thinks guns are weak in the same way that Batman does. And so there are no guns in the school. He's training them. And it's so, you know, really when I go to the easiest comps, I go to, it's as if Richard Linkletter made Kill Bill. So that it's a very character-driven story with a lot of heart. But then there's a heightened reality, heightened world, sort of, you know, assassin's school. But that all of the violence is born out of character, and that what we focus more on is, instead of the big salacious action, is the consequences to the kids coming out of it, which was the thing I wanted to make the book. You know, as a victim of a lot of violence growing up and having seen people shot and killed and all of the things that I've witnessed, for me, the thing I wanted to explore was the effects that violence had on me. Probably, you know, to this day, you know, I still am waiting for some shit to go down. In any crowded place, I go in and I'm like on edge and on nerve and like, where is this gonna head? Because once those normal situations coming out of a movie theater and had, you know, three guys grab me and beat me near to death, you come out of a movie theater the rest of your life and you're ready for three guys to grab you and beat you near to death. And so the violence is heightened, and, you know, it's still exciting, and you still want to do those nice choreographed, you know, scenes of Saya doing flips and kicks and stuff. But ultimately, what's really interesting is to get in and figure out the ramifications of the violence and what it does to the human psyche and what it does to these young people in the story.
How different is the comic, is the TV show going to be from the comic?
Well, not very. I mean, you know, like I said, there's going to be fine-tuning because I think that, like you said, there's things in the book that Wes can make look beautiful that when you see actual people doing them, you feel hinky. So it's just about reconsidering a few of those things, you know, like making sure there's no guns in the school and that we never see anything like that. But in the book, it's always been something where the violence is, you know,
born of character stuff, and ultimately the more interesting aspect of it is the consequence of the violence and the characters and what happens to them. Billy killing his dad is a couple pages in a book. But for me, the best part of that story is when Billy is on the run and he remembers his dad, you know, a few months later, and realizes that when his dad was alive, even though his dad was abusive and didn't love him, there was always a hope in Billy's heart that his dad might one day change his mind and love him. And now now he never will. That's the part of the story that matters, not the part where they go and do the thing. So we are following the book, and you know, that's been my intent from the beginning, is to make sure that it doesn't get mutated into something that's unrecognizable. I think you're going to be watching the book on TV, and you're going to be watching it with a great budget and people like, you know, Joe Russo, who have a hand in making sure that it's A-level material. But while also sort of having much more real estate and much more time to unpack it and really get full optics on who all these people are, in a way that, you know, there's only one Wes Craig, so I can only get him to draw so many pages.
I don't want to be productive of all the beautiful things you just said, but can we expect a hallway fight scene? I know there've become like these huge like pinnacle moments in the Marvel Netflix universe, and it's completely not a part of that. But maybe.
There's a lot of heightened Kill Bill, like in the book. It's an assassin school. I think that is long, but what we have challenged ourselves to do, as we did in the book, is anytime there's violence, it's indicative of something. I always go back to the scene where Marcus and Saya are in the graveyard, and he's dating Maria, and she is trying to help him not get killed. And all of a sudden, a cloaked figure shoots an arrow at him, and Saya catches it before it hits him. And then he chases the cloaked person and grabs it, and it's Maria. It's the jealousy issue in a love triangle is then magnified and made physical in the shooting of a bow and arrow. You know what I mean? So it's just like, it's just taking those universal things that we all experienced and all of those understandable, relatable experiences, and then just heightening that into a school for assassins, because it's exciting and it's fun to see those fight sequences, provided there's a contextual reason for them and it's not salacious and stupid where we're just watching people beat each other. Like, again, The Raid is great if you watch 5 minutes of The Raid. I get to a point with The Raid where it's like white noise, you know, I'm like, okay, and he's breaking that guy's arm and I don't fucking know what to do here. So it's just a matter of making sure that all that stuff is there. It's exciting when it comes, but it's just little drips and drabs.
What was the casting process like? I'm assuming you sat in on it and defined the right.
It's hard. I mean, you know, we were months and months watching people read the sides and going through one option after another. And this person's better at this, and this is great here. And then you're going through this. And then some of them were just immediate hires right off the bat. First read, you're like, there we go. But it was, you know, I think that the time and energy we put in, and, you know, look, we had a lot of voices, and we had, you know, Joe Russo and the team from that he uses on Marvel to do the casting for the Marvel movies, did the casting for Deadly Class. Like, having Joe Russo means that you have all of Joe Russo and his Agwell company's resources and all of his years of experience and all the people that he uses. So we have been using his people, and his people are all fantastic. And so what we're getting is top of the line greatness. And so it's a hell of a lot of fun. You know, it really is to hear really talented people bring that to life and to get all these various takes. The hard part is then sort of, you know, sitting at a table like this with all of the, you know, producers and co-EPs and everyone, and trying to decide on the right choice.
Do we know how long the season, like how many episodes?
I do, but I don't know if I'm allowed to say. That might be it, yeah.
Okay. Hopefully it's not like one season, 1 year. I don't like when things are rushed to fit in like a season.
No. Okay. We're actually opening it up. Because the thing for me that I had just rewatched a bunch of Linkletter, I'd watched Dazed and Confused, and I'd rewatched the Before Sunrise trilogy. And I love what Linkletter does with just character interaction and just intelligent human conversation, where you're captivated and engrossed and there's nothing happening. There's no plot, we've lost that sort of, that's a big staple of a lot of Gen X. They say that Slackers is the quintessential Generation X movie. And so that's a big staple that I want to, you know, I've put that in the book. It's been a big influence for me. I want to continue that through. And so to that end, we're just leaving giant pockets of just, what happens there? You know, writer's choice. These three characters are in their dorm or walking through the hallways or smoking a joint or whatever, and they're talking. And so to that end, we've enabled it to land in a nice place. We've got, you know, we've got three seasons planned. God knows if we get to them, you know. But I think that the real point of it is to make sure we don't rush, and that you really love these kids, and that you get a snapshot of the era in the same way Mad Men gave you a snapshot of the late 50s.
So you talked about writing, going back and forth. When you're, and you also mentioned how you write very minimal sometimes for Wes. You just, you know, say a sentence and then he does it. When you're writing stuff now, are you also kind of thinking about should the show ever get to that point that maybe you might want to describe it a little differently? Or?
No, I am practicing the uncomfortable act of optimism, which is a very foreign concept to my brain. But as I'm developing, I am considering, look, you know, I mean, we're building season one thinking we're getting season two. We're not, you know, if it was like Game of Thrones had gotten you over the wall and right to the White Walkers in episode seven, season one, it would have been shitty. Joe Russo has a saying that he loves, which is a muscular restraint. And we are practicing muscular restraint to ensure that we are taking our time, taking a breath, not rushing through. We are writing for people. We are trying to write for the smartest person in the room, not the dumbest. And we're trying to make sure that what we come out of the other end with can lead into seasons four, five, six, seven, and that we can, you know, maybe see the series progress to that point. But I wouldn't say that I'm so while I'm keeping in mind the sort of the trajectory of the story and knowing where it goes, you know, I'm still writing. When I'm like, you know, the episode I just finished writing before I left is a whole lot of things that I wanted to do in the book and then got cut because of space requirements. And that's just, you know, stories of these kids, you know, and it doesn't necessarily require me to alter it considering what we might do in season two, I don't think.
Post Iron Fist, where the internet sort of devoured the lead actor for not being prepared enough to do the physicality the role required, what did you guys have prepared for your actors to go through? Is there a fight captain, 2 weeks, 6 weeks, a month?
Yeah, and they've been in training. I mean, you can go on to Lana and Maria's Instagram and watch them training together fight sequences. I mean, like, you know, and then Ben has been, you know, starving himself because he's an emaciated street urchin. He was already thin as a rail, and I made the mistake of telling him, you know, like, Marcus hasn't had a lot of square meals. And he came back, and I was like, no, dude, eat a sandwich. they're taking it incredibly seriously. And so we have a lot of great stunt coordinators and people involved in this and ensuring that comes across. And when you see the pilot and you see what we're doing later, you get an eyeful of what we're doing here. And, you know, and then having Joe and Anthony Russo come into the editing bay with us and help us tweak the action and you know, with their little tricks of trade, it's fucking great. It's really great. Yeah. So there's not going to be any of that.
You talk about writing to the smartest person in the room, which is awesome. Like, that's the kind of shows that I like to watch, too. Do you ever fear that the dumbest person in the room is going to read the movie or the show, sorry, the wrong way and, like, maybe take from it, oh, I should go drop acid and join an assassin school?
Well, I don't think that that's a level of dumb. I don't think
extreme, obviously,
but that's the bigger conversation is, you know, you're asking, are people informed by entertainment to go out and reenact these things? And, you know, that there's no answering that question. I don't personally believe so. You know, I don't think anybody's going to, is there going to be a whole generation we're not glamorizing acid. The acid story is based on a potentially personal story. And it's an indictment. It's not a go acid. That can be really bad times. And so hopefully the thing is that you're dealing with a kid who is a depressive, and that's really more of the focus of it. It's an honest examination of what it's like to be a depressive. And ultimately what this kid is doing is medicating, and he's medicating with drugs. And he is hurting himself with drugs. And if somebody watches this and comes out the other end thinking that they want to hurt themselves with drugs, I don't think this show is the thing that was necessarily going to light that fuse. But at the end of the day, you have to make your art and, you know, make it smart. And hopefully you get it.
What was it like seeing Deadly Class on the trains outside the convention center?
I haven't seen the trains yet, but when I drove in last night and I was just driving looking for the streets, and I looked to the left and there was a bus, so Deadly Class was just filling my view, and I was like, what? It's a very strange dimension to have ended up in. This is a strange timeline. Yeah, it's great. It's really fulfilling. I mean, you know, I was down at the Image booth where they've got the big banner up on the wall. And, you know, I came to my first Comic-Con 25 years ago as a retailer, and I came to my first Comic-Con as a pro in 1998 when I was an animator and making the first issues of Captain Dingleberry, sitting at a table in the very, very back of the hall that a back issue sale company had given us a piece of their table with Captain Dingleberry 1 and 2 and a Captain Dingleberry banner, and just people walking by and be like, it's a comic that's, it's supposed to be funny, it's, I don't know, satire. And then coming, you know, 20 years later to see that, you know, it puts a smile on the face. But it'll all blow up and everything's going to go wrong anyway. Oh.
She's like, we were so close.
Well, thanks for making fuck you comics, because they're the punk version of comic books, man.
Thank you. So. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. I say it all the time, podcast articles, though, that's my favorite comic.
Thanks, dude. Yeah. Appreciate that, Tony. Really, that's nice to hear. So hopefully we can, you know, make you love the show, too. I think that you will. I think you'll like it.
Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast, Barron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barron Space production.